snow.
It won't be long before we'll all be there with snow.
Snow. I want to wash my hands, my face, and hair with snow.
That's a cut from the song Snow from the musical White Christmas. The plot of that Irving Berlin show takes place a decade after World War II. It's about two army buddies who make it big in show business and then try to help their former commanding general from their war days. We'll meet two of the cast members of the Broadway tour and company of White Christmas later on this hour. The period during which most of the show takes place is in the mid-1950s, when optimism was pretty much at its highest. The world is no longer in a hot war, at least, and the U.S. and its allies have emerged victorious and apparently stronger than ever. But in the days just after the bombing of Pearl Harbor in December 1941, the world was anything but secure, and Americans wondered what to expect in this new war. They look to their leaders here and overseas, where Europe already was embroiled in the battle of its life against Hitler and the Nazis. Joining us now to talk about those early days after Pearl Harbor is Stanley Weintraub, the Evan Pugh Professor Emeritus of Arts and Humanities at Penn State University. He's also the author of many histories and biographies, including most recently Pearl Harbor Christmas, A World at War, December 1941, just out this month in paperback. Welcome to the show, Professor Weintraub.
Thank you. Glad to be with you.
Your book is a quite sweeping look back at the roughly 3 weeks or so following the bombing of Pearl Harbor. It's amazing the areas you cover, from the inner sanctum of the Japanese and German militaries to MacArthur and the Pacific Theater to Washington, D.C., where Winston Churchill quickly traveled to plot the war ahead with Franklin Roosevelt. Churchill moved very quickly. Within 5 days, he was getting ready to leave because he was worried about the isolationist movement in the U.S. and that it might prevail?
I think he was also worried that because of the attack on Pearl Harbor, the United States would pursue a Japan-first strategy, which in effect was impossible because we had lost our Pacific Fleet. He wanted a Germany-first strategy.
What were the expectations when he was coming over? And I don't know whether I missed it, but was he secretly coming over?
Yes, he was secretly coming over, but he first thought of flying, and then he realized that because of the weather circumstances in the winter and the chanciness of flying in general, he'd have to go to Nova Scotia first and then travel south to Washington, that maybe he was better if he came by battleship. And so he commandeered the biggest and newest battleship in the British Navy, the Duke of York, and sailed in stormy North Atlantic waters to the USA.
Was there any danger of the German U-boats or anything like that? Were those waters a problem that way?
The U-boats were out in the North Atlantic, but the weather was stormy. And the Duke of York was faster than any German submarine, and so it could evade the submarines. And it was slow getting to the U.S. because of the stormy weather. But nevertheless, he did make it to Newport News, Virginia. He was very eager to get to the White House, and the White House sent a plane to Virginia to pick him up and a few of his staff and to fly him to Washington. They were all shocked to see all the bright lights of the U.S. because Britain was under blackout, and America was already full of Christmas trees.
Right. Nothing of the sort. It was, in fact, I mean, still in those early days after Pearl Harbor, except for the mourning, of course, that was going on, it was a lot of festivity as usual.
Nothing much had changed because America had gone on a Christmas footing, as usual, around Thanksgiving Day. And so the stores were full of goodies. Christmas trees sold at about $2. It was a very different world. Churchill knew that the facts about Pearl Harbor were that we suffered the worst military defeat in our history, but he was sure that they would now win the war because America, with its vast resources, would be at the aid of Britain. On the other hand, Hitler, across the ocean, saw Japan as winning the war for him. He said, "We now have an ally who has not lost a war in 3,000 years, So he was elated by the Japanese attack and that the Japanese had opened a new front against American Britain.
My guest, if you're just joining us, is Stanley Weintraub. He's an author, historian, professor emeritus at Penn State University. We're talking about his book, Pearl Harbor Christmas, A World at War, December 1941. It came out last year, and it just was released in paperback this year. The Japanese and Germans, they're now new allies, but they're not as chummy as the U.S. and Britain. They really don't have that much in common.
They weren't very chummy, but the Japanese had a former admiral as ambassador in Berlin, who was the contact between the two nations. And they did manage a traffic of military supplies by submarine back and forth. They couldn't do it by surface vessel very easily, but they also did that. And the Germans found it was very difficult in December 1941 to even dock in a Japanese port because the Japanese were suspicious of the Germans, although they were their allies technically.
Well, they were into the superior race, and Japanese are a different cut from a different bolt. I mean, wasn't there a lot of insecurity about that they would be next?
Both the Japanese felt that they were racially superior.
Right.
After all, they had dominated the Pacific Rim. They had been at war with China. They'd eaten up vast tracts of China. They had taken over French Indochina. They were on their way now to capture Malaya and the Dutch Indies, which are now Indonesia. They felt that they could win the war if they wanted very quickly. And Admiral Yamamoto, who had planned the Pearl Harbor strategy, felt that the Japanese had about a year to win the war. If they couldn't bring America to sue for peace within a year because of defeatism in America, which he hoped would occur, then America's military might, because of its industrial power, would begin to take effect and the Japanese would lose. So he felt they had a year.
And the Germans, on the other hand, thought the war was going to be over by that January.
They thought the war was going to be over by Christmas.
Right, Christmas, yeah.
But they got bogged down in Russia and the snows. And in fact, they got bogged down so badly that their troops didn't have winter clothing. They thought the war would be over before the Russian winter. And Hitler went on the radio to appeal for winter clothes to be donated for the troops, claiming that these would be gifts for Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
The Nazis didn't believe in Christmas. They, in fact, outlawed its celebration. But suddenly Hitler was on the air asking for Christmas presents for the troops.
Because he didn't want people to know how desperately they actually needed this stuff.
Yes, and in fact, although they needed it desperately, there was actually no way to get the volume of gifts to the front.
I was thinking about these two world leaders, Churchill and Roosevelt, spending the holidays together like that, and wondered if anything like that had ever happened before or since in peace or war.
No, I don't think it had. This was like the classic American play, The Man Who Came to Dinner.
Right.
Churchill did not expect to stay as long as he did, but he was having a good time, and he was also trying to push the Americans into a stronger case for war in Europe and in North Africa. And it was a very strange time for Churchill. He bedded at the White House. He called Roosevelt's butler to his bedroom and told him what he needed, and he especially needed 90-year-old brandy for breakfast. And the butler said, of course, yes, and he didn't get any 90-year-old brandy, but he got a lot of liquor during the time he was in the White House. And the president was amused by all of this, but he took it in stride. He took Churchill to church on Christmas Day.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first time, Churchill sang Christmas carols. He wasn't a churchgoer. He had never heard A Little Town of Bethlehem before. It was written by Americans in Philadelphia. So that was new to him. And on New Year's Day later, he went to church in Alexandria, Virginia with Roosevelt. So for the first time in his life, within 10 days, he had gone to church twice.
Did he feel any sense of homesickness of being away from England at such a precarious time, even though he was on, you know, doing very important work and he was very devoted to it? It was also during the holidays.
He was delighted to be in America because of all the resources that were available. Mm-hmm. He even called his wife Clementine and asked her stocking size because nylons were available in America, and they certainly weren't in England. He spoke to Congress the day after Christmas and told Congress that if his mother had been English instead of American and his father American instead of English, he might have come to Congress in another guise. He might have been president.
How did Americans like him?
They thought he was wonderful. He was witty, and he could give impromptu remarks. The day before Christmas, Roosevelt had him at a press conference in the White House. Roosevelt, of course, was enfeebled by infantile paralysis and sat in his chair. But Churchill could stand up and answer questions from the reporters. And the reporters cried out, "We can't see you, we can't see you." They had crowded into the Oval Office, and Churchill was short. Roosevelt said, "Stand on a chair." And Churchill stood on a chair and talked to the reporters.
He also headed to Canada for a period.
Yes, he went to Canada the day after Christmas and spoke to the Canadian Parliament. And the famous picture of that scowling Churchill, that's probably the most famous portrait of him, was taken in Ottawa, Canada, on that trip. A photographer, a very famous photographer, asked him to pose for a picture, and Churchill scowled and said he wouldn't do it. But the photographer, who was Josef Karsh, took the cigar out of Churchill's mouth, actually pulled it out of his mouth, and snapped the picture, and Churchill was scowling even more. And it's a very famous portrait of Churchill, and it's in my book.
Yes, it is in your book on page 173. I enjoyed hearing the story or reading the story behind it. All in all, I was wondering about why you decided to focus on this particular period. We are always talking. We have shows about Pearl Harbor. We think about it every year on December 7th, but you went right into the heart of it all and went around the world with it.
Yeah, I think that people don't realize how shocked America was after Pearl Harbor, and they don't realize what the world was like in those weeks between Christmas and New Year's, when normally we had a celebratory time, and suddenly it wasn't that at all. And many Americans realized this would be the last real Christmas for a long time until the war was over.
Well, Stanley Weintraub, thanks for joining us today to talk about it. We really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Stanley Weintraub, author, historian, and professor emeritus at Penn State University. We've been talking about his book. It's called Pearl Harbor Christmas, A World at War, December 1941. Coming up, we're going to hear from a World War II vet about his time during Christmas in the war. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
Start your day with local updates from the award-winning WOSU News team.
Twice a day, school bus drivers travel around the city to bring students to school and then take them home. But some students are waiting at bus stops for a long time. Director of Transportation for Columbus City Schools, Steve Simmons, places much of the blame on a shortage of drivers.
You have to what's called double and triple up routes.
Hear the latest in local and national news on Morning Edition on 89.7 NPR News, your all-day NPR news station.
This is 89.7 NPR News, and sustaining givers are the future of our station. A sustainer gives a fixed amount each month. Visit WOSU.org/sustainer to sign up, and thanks for your support. And support for 89.7 comes from the Jazz Arts Group, continuing their 40th anniversary season with a holiday tradition. The Columbus Jazz Orchestra performs with Broadway star Marva Hicks in Home for the Holidays, November 29th through December 2nd at the Southern Theater. Details at jazzartsgroup.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The best things happen while you're dancing. Things that you would not do at home come naturally on the floor for dancing.
That's The Best Things Happen When You're Dancing from the musical White Christmas, a post-World War II story about helping others and finding joy in the little things when fame and fortune aren't always enough. We'll be talking to some cast members of the production that's here in Columbus through Sunday a little later in the show. Right now, we return to World War II, but this time near the end. The Allies have occupied Germany, and by then, Toledo native Val Farnham, who served in the military from October 1944 to April 1946, had participated in three battle campaigns. 89-year-old Val has been on the show before to talk about his extensive memoirs. He joins us again today to share his latest writings about the Christmas he spent in a small Bavarian village where he was stationed as a U.S. Army soldier. The following story details the Christmas he spent as a U.S. Army soldier stationed once again in a small Bavarian village. Welcome to the show, Val.
Thank you.
We appreciate it. We don't often hear a lot about what happened in Germany after the war. Why were you there and what were you doing at the time?
Well, we were a part of the Army of Occupation, and we were also an engineer battalion. And Hitler had damaged his roads so bad that for even our military to travel down the Autobahn, it needed several repairs. We did not do major repairs, but repairs adequate to keep our military moving.
And so you found yourself there during Christmas. What year was this that you're going to tell us about?
1945.
Okay, 1945. Do you want to just start reading?
Yes, I will.
Okay.
I'd be glad to.
Thank you.
In the midsummer 1945, I was assigned to an engineer battalion charged with repairing sections of the German Autobahn and the country's main highway. My company was stationed in Bergen, Germany, a small village at the foot of the Bavarian Alps and across the Autobahn from Traunstein. The village and its surroundings offer a beautiful setting in both summer and winter. One of its neighboring villages is Berchtesgaden. With 3 years of high school German behind me and my pocket dictionary in hand, I was zoned up on my buddies in the battalion. Early in my tour in Bergen, I met two little girls who often waited outside the GI mess hall. The GI retained their leftovers after a meal, both food and coffee. Women, children, and displaced persons waited outside the mess hall with empty containers. The GI poured his coffee into one container and banged his mess kit until the leftover food dropped into the other. For those of you who have experienced farm life, it was more like slopping pigs. To those waiting outside the line, it provided a regal repast. The two girls I met were Elfriede and Hildegard Ladenbacher. They did not speak English. After meeting them in the food line, I invited them to stop by my building, where I was billeted for a candy bar or a piece of gum. Thus began a great friendship. We met many times on our building's second floor balcony for conversation. Our talks included translation of the comics and the Stars and Stripes, the GI newspaper. Sometimes they brought their friends. I always attempted to have something for them, as well as soap for their mother. In the warm months, we went for walks in the village. When the snow came, they attempted to teach me to ski, or they attended the GI movie night. Most movies were cartoons and didn't require a translation. In many meetings together, we learned about one another, especially the turmoil and survival of the Great War. All the while, I remained thankful for my good old pocket dictionary. In December 1945, I had hoped to be back in Toledo, Ohio, spending the holidays with my family. However, Uncle Sam did not see it that way. I was destined to remain in Bergen with my fellow GIs. Perhaps I could attend the village Catholic church, but I would not be able to turn the pages of my dictionary fast enough to translate the pastor's message. I did know the first verse of O Tannenbaum if they sang carols. Another option, I could have been assigned guard duty or put in charge of quarters. The good Lord had other plans for me that holiday. A day or two before Christmas, two little girls were standing at my door. They seemed excited as they told me their mother had invited me to have dinner and celebrate Christmas with them. For a lonely GI and one who was ever curious about his new German friends, the invitation was a gift of grace from God.
Excuse me, I just want to let people know you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News, and you're listening to Val Farnham, a World War II veteran, read from his memoir about Christmas in 1945 in a Bavarian village where he was stationed. Go ahead, Val, I'm sorry.
As I was escorted in the second floor apartment that Christmas afternoon, there before me was a beautiful tree lighted with candles. I know my grandmother Dietz had some of those candles, but I had never seen them on a tree. An old-looking stranger sat in the corner of the room. He could hardly speak and was introduced to me as a girl's father. I later learned he was a Jehovah's Witness and Hitler had incarcerated him in Dachau. Now he spent his days in a sanatorium, but was released to his family for the holiday. We shared a Christmas dinner of Wurst, Schwarzbrot, and Käse. The coffee was German Ersatz, or some that the GI had poured into the family's container outside the mess hall the previous day.